upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And welcome to today's broadcast. Patrick Wood here for Technocracy News and Trends, Editor-in-Chief. The first target of our news today is Microsoft, that bastion of technocrats from Seattle area. Microsoft, which is founded, of course, by Bill Gates, has been busy and supporting smart city technology around the world, and especially in the United States. It has recently announced that it's putting its third smart cities tech hub in Syracuse, New York. I wrote in this article, technocrats at Microsoft will promote application development for 5G, Internet of Things, and artificial intelligence in a quest to flood cities with smart city command and control systems. And that is exactly what their intent is. The article states the software giant Microsoft plans to open a hub in Syracuse aimed at developing uses for new technology, aiding tech startups, and training the workforce of the future. Microsoft will establish a smart city technology hub as part of Mayor Ben Walsh's Syracuse Surge plan to bolster the regional economy with high-tech jobs. It's Microsoft's third such hub in the nation and the first in the Northeast. It's significant for us, Walsh said Tuesday afternoon. It's third-party validation not only of the Surge and a strategy, but the partnership and leadership we have in the community. Microsoft announced similar hubs earlier this year in Louisville, Kentucky, and Houston, Texas. The Microsoft announcement reflects the second major corporation to show an interest in Walsh's Surge strategy. Earlier this year, J.P. Morgan Chase committed $3 million towards workforce training programs and to ensure economic growth included traditionally disenfranchised communities. Details of Microsoft's physical location in Syracuse haven't yet been finalized. Walsh said the software company plans to locate somewhere on the south end of downtown in the footprint of the pending Southside campus for the new economy. Microsoft will staff the hub with its employees, though city officials weren't sure how many. For now, Walsh has asked the Common Council to approve a memorandum of understanding between the city, Onondaga County, Syracuse University's iSchool, and Microsoft. The council could vote on that agreement as early as Monday. The agreement formalizes a three-year partnership between the school, the governments, and the tech company, and outlines some of what Microsoft will bring to Syracuse. According to that agreement, the hub will be a resource for entrepreneurs and startup companies, providing consulting services, education, and training on burgeoning technology, catch this now, like 5G, artificial intelligence, and the Internet of Things. And there you have it. This is exactly what Microsoft's Tech Center is all about, and it's about blanketing the nation with smart city technology. Of course, there's a lot of other tech companies lined up right beside Microsoft, or perhaps right behind them, to do the same thing. The second story is a little bit grotesque on the surface of it. Those of you who have read George Orwell's 1984, that classic dystopian book that was written in 1948, know the storyline and the outcome. And in the end of it, the hero of that book was left sitting at a lonely table in a little bar, drinking his obligatory glass of rotgut gin, thinking to himself how much he loved Big Brother. Because after all, Big Brother was taking care of him. And that was after he underwent incredible brainwashing and torture and other things to come to the realization that he was obligated to think whatever Big Brother told him to think. So the title of this story is called Coming Soon, Meds and Techniques to Erase Memories. Just the title gives you enough to think about, doesn't it? Meds and Techniques to Erase Memories. Well, who would want to erase a memory? Well, I wrote at the top of this article, Orwell's Torture Room 101 to Adjust Memories may be a thing of the past, as technocrat scientists are nearing a drug-related solution to help you erase memories, whether good or bad. Is 2 plus 2 really 4, or is it 5? And of course, that was the question in the book 1984 that was given to the hero. He said 4, they said 5, so the torture was on until he agreed that 2 and 2 equals 5. The article states, the 60 souls that signed on to Dr. Elaine Brunette's memory manipulation study were unified by something they would rather not remember, the trauma of betrayal. For some, it was infidelity, and for others, a brutal, unanticipated abandonment. It was very like, I'm leaving you, goodbye, the McGill University Associate Professor of Psychiatry says. In cold clinical terms, his parents were suffering from an adjustment disorder due to the termination, not of their choosing, of a romantic relationship. The goal of Brunette and other researchers is to help people like this, the scorned, the betrayed, the traumatized, lose their total recall to deliberately forget. Over 4 to 6 sessions, volunteers read aloud from a typed script they had composed themselves, a first-person account of their breakup, with as many emotional details as possible. While under the influence of the drug propranolol, a common and inexpensive blood pressure pill, the idea was to purposely reactivate the memory and bring the experience and the stinging emotions it aroused to life again. How did you feel about that? They were asked. How do you feel right now? And most importantly, has your memory changed since last week? The investigators had hypothesized that 4 to 6 sessions of memory reactivation under propranolol would be sufficient to dramatically blunt the memories associated with their attachment injury. Decrease the strength of the memory, Brunette says, and you decrease the strength of the pain. The study is now complete, and Brunette is hesitant to discuss the results, which have been submitted to a journal for peer review and publication. However, the participants just couldn't believe we could do so much in such a small amount of time, he confides. They were able to turn the page. That's what they would tell us. I feel like I've turned the page. I'm no longer obsessed by this person or this relationship. Brunette insists he isn't interested in deleting or scrubbing painful memories out entirely. The idea of memory erasure, of finding the cellular imprint of a specific discrete memory in the brain, of isolating and inactivating the brain cell behind the memory, unnerves him. It's not going to come from my lab, he says, although others are certainly working on it. Memories are part of who we are, what forms our identity, what makes us authentic. And as long as only one choice exists right now, and it's toning down a memory, we feel on very solid and comfortable ground, ethically speaking, Brunette says. However, if one day you had two options, I can tone down your memory or I can remove it altogether from your head, from your mind, what would you choose? The choice might soon be yours. If you could erase the memory of the worst day in your life, would you? Elizabeth Phelps and Stefan Hoffman write in the journal Nature. How about the memory of the person who caused your pain? What was once only pure science fiction is moving ever closer to clinical reality. Researchers are working on techniques and drugs that might enable us to edit our memories or at least seriously dull their impact to make the intolerable bearable. By, say, swallowing a pill to block the synaptic changes needed for a memory to solidify, a pill that could be taken hours, even months or years after the event. Much of the work is based on the theory of memory reconsolidation, the belief that the mere conscious act of recalling or conjuring a memory makes it vulnerable to tinkering or meddling. When a memory is evoked, a reconsolidation window opens up for a brief period of time, 2 to 5 hours, according to Brunette, during which time the memory returns to a state of liability. It becomes pliable, like Play-Doh. It also becomes susceptible to modification, before reconsolidating or restorage. The thought is that propranolol interferes with proteins in the brain needed to lock down the memory again. A similar line of thinking holds that a memory isn't an exact impression of the original event, that is, an iPhone video of the past, says Bolton University neuroscientist Steve Ramirez. Rather, it's more like Plato's wax tablet. Press a signet ring into the wax, and it leaves an imprint. But the wax can melt when we recall the memory, form again, and then melt all over again. Memory is dynamic, Ramirez says. It isn't static. Memories can also be updated with new information when they're recalled, like hitting save as every time you go into a Word file. Well, we won't elaborate on the idea of editing and modifying memories, but you can see where this is headed. Technocrat scientists who seriously want to pursue this are pursuing it with no ethical checks or boundaries. The outcome could be extremely unnerving and even dangerous. The last story is going to dig into a little bit of history and a little bit of future. The title of this final and most important story is Sustainable Failure, the Global Fertility Crash. The Global Fertility Crash. I wrote at the top of this article, contrary to UN and globalist propaganda, global population is crashing, not exploding. The birth rate in many countries is so low that they will cease to exist as discrete nations. For many, the trend is already irreversible. Declining population guarantees huge reductions in economic activity, productivity, and economic security. Inflation will turn to deflation, and wars will be fought over the precious remaining resources and how to get them to the people to survive. This is an incredibly important story, and I encourage everyone to read this story word for word and get the memory planted in your brain. Don't erase that memory like the previous story, but get this one planted solidly in your mind. There is no population bomb. There is no 10 billion people in the future of planet Earth. It just ain't gonna happen. And you read this story and listen to the video embedded in it, and you will understand perfectly well why. The story states at least 2 children per woman. That's what's needed to ensure a stable population from generation to generation. In the 1960s, the fertility rate was 5 live births per woman. By 2017, it had fallen to 2.43. That's half, close to that critical threshold. Population growth is vital for the world economy. It means more workers to build homes and produce goods, more consumers to buy things and spark innovation, and more citizens to pay taxes and attract trade. While the world is expected to add more than 3 billion people by 2100, according to the United Nations, that'll likely be the high point. Falling fertility rates and aging populations will mean serious challenges that will be felt more acutely in several places than others. Now, let me point out here as an aside, citing what the United Nations says about population is a very weak and lame attempt to override what they're saying in this study. There is no way that we're going to add 3 billion people by 2100. And again, let's read on and you'll see why. While the global average fertility rate was still above the rate of replacement, technically 2.1 children per woman in 2017, about half of all countries had already fallen below it, up from 1 in 20 just half a century ago. For places such as the U.S. and parts of Western Europe, which historically are attractive to migrants, loosening immigration policies could make up for low birth rates. In other places, more drastic policy interventions may be called for. Most of the available options place a high burden on women, who will be relied upon not only to bear children, but also to help fill widening gaps in the workforce. Each of the following indicators, in a chart below, tells a part of the global fertility story, not just how many babies women have on average, but also how well women are integrated into the workforce, what slice of the income pie they receive, and their level of educational attainment. Government attempts to manage population growth are nothing new. Consider the generous paid maternal leave of the Scandinavian countries, or China's recently rescinded one-child policy, each relatively effective in achieving its stated goal, but a new sense of urgency and even desperation is creeping into the search for ways to reverse the current trends. That said, achieving robust population growth is by no means the only contributor to economic growth. In some countries, too high fertility may actually be a drag on GDP because of higher costs. But as these indicators suggest, it can be an important tailwind. To explore these demographic and economic shifts, Bloomberg analyzed fertility data for 200 countries and picked four that were outliers in some respect. Local reporters then interviewed one woman in each place about her economic and cultural forces that shaped her choice to have children or not. And what this story finally discovered is that many countries are headed straight down below the replacement rate and also below the point of no return. That means that they will never recover their population and that the population of that country will continue to shrink. This is exactly where the world is right now. There are only a handful of countries who still have a positive birth rate that is over 2.1. Some have upwards of 4 or 4.5. But by and large, all of the old birth rates that we saw back in the 50s and 60s, those days are simply gone. So all of the hype today about population growth is just nonsense. It's science that's so bad that it makes you think of global warming science, that is, global warming pseudoscience, that claims the world is going to burn up when more evidence is mounting that there's more likely going to be a little ice age straight ahead of us instead of a global burnout. But in this case, this was all started, you remember, back in the late 1960s by the book Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. He was a professor at the time, but not a professor of anthropology or sociology. He never studied demographics before. In fact, his PhD was in entomology. That's right, he was a bug scientist. He studied bugs. And he rolled his bug science over on the human population and said, gee, if humans multiply like crickets, the world is going to soon be overrun by people. There won't be enough food to go around, and there'll be a huge die-off by starvation. They call it the population bomb. Sold millions of copies around the world, was translated into multiple languages. It's still being sold like crazy today, and all of the people at the United Nations and every other NGO that follows the United Nations around the world, they all continue to pump out Ehrlich's lies that he stated in the population bomb. Correction, in his book, Population Bomb. Not one of his predictions ever came true. Not a single one. And it's amazing that he has any credibility whatsoever today, but he does. And I have to say, the reason why he has any credibility whatsoever is because he and all of his followers are wrapped up in the religion of scientism, which throws logic out and says the only source of truth is through scientific discovery. And the problem is, of course, as we discussed many times before in the pages of Technocracy News and Trends, scientism is not pro-science any way, shape, or form. In fact, it's anti-science because it always excludes the other side of the equation. Their science is always settled. They will accept no rebuttal. They will accept no evidence to the contrary, no argument to the contrary. You either agree with them or, as Al Gore said a few years ago, if you're a denier, you deserve to be punished. And this is exactly what happens. So as you think about sustainable development, you think about Agenda 21, 2030 Agenda, the New Urban Agenda, all of the stories coming out on smart cities and how all the people in the world are going to move into cities and they're going to grow and grow and grow, and the cities are going to be the economic bastions of humanity. Just remember, population is dying. It's going down. The curve is headed down. Many countries in 50 years will not even be on the face of the planet anymore because their population just disintegrates. And that includes, by the way, the United States. If all else remains the same in the United States, we too will be gone as a nation. Of course, on the other hand, those globalists who are promoting immigration are basically stealing citizens from other countries and encouraging them to come to the countries that aren't making it, hopefully to keep it going. Well, it's not working, but that was part of the idea behind immigration in Europe, and that's part of the idea behind the open border that we have on our southern border. Well, I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time. We'll be right back.